How was school today? I asked, elaborately casual.
All right, he said.
Did you learn anything? His father asked.
Laurie regarded his father coldly.
I didn't learn nothing, he said.
Anything, I said. Didn't learn anything.
The teacher spanked the boy, though, Laurie said, addressing his bread and butter.
For being fresh, he added with his mouth full.
What did he do, I asked.
Who was it?
Laurie thought.
Notice that, he thought.
It was Charles, he said. He was fresh. The teacher spanked him and made him stand in a corner. He was awfully fresh.
What did he do, I asked again.
But Laurie slid off his chair, took a cookie, and left while his father was still saying, see here, son. The next day, Laurie remarked at lunch, as soon as he sat down,
well, Charles was bad again today.
He grinned enormously and said, today Charles hit the teacher.
I suppose he got spanked again?
He sure did, Laurie said. Look up, he said to his father.
What? His father said, looking up.
Look down, Laurie said. Look at my thumb.
You're dumb. He began laughing insanely.
Why did Charles hit the teacher, I asked quickly.
Because she tried to make him color with red crayons, Laurie said.
Charles wanted to color with green crayons, so he hit the teacher and she spanked him and said nobody played with Charles, but everybody did.
The third day, it was Wednesday of the first week, Charles bounced a seesaw onto the head of a little girl and made her bleed, and the teacher made him stay inside all during recess. Thursday, Charles had to stay in the corner during story time because he kept pounding his feet on the floor. Friday, Charles was deprived of blackboard privileges because he threw chalk. On Saturday, I remarked to my husband, you think kindergarten is too unsettling for Laurie? All this toughness and bad grammar and this Charles boy sounds like such a bad influence.
It'll be all right, my husband said reassuringly. Bound to be people like Charles in the world. Might as well meet them now as later.
On Monday, Laurie came home late, full of news.
Charles, he shouted as he came up the hill.
I was waiting anxiously at the front steps.
Charles, Laurie yelled all the way up the hill. Charles was bad again.
Come right in, I said, as soon as he came close enough. Lunch is waiting.
You know what Charles did? He demanded, following me through the door. Charles yelled so in school they sent a boy in from first grade to tell the teacher she had to make Charles keep quiet. And so Charles had to stay after school, and so all the children stayed with him.
What did he do, I asked.
He just sat there, Laurie said, climbing into his chair at the table. Hi, Pop, yelled Dust Mop.
Charles had to stay after school today, I told my husband. Everyone stayed with him.
What does Charles look like, my husband asked Laurie. What's his other name?
He's bigger than me, Laurie said, and he doesn't have any rubbers, and he doesn't even wear a jacket.
Monday night was the first parent-teacher meeting, and only the fact that the baby had a cold kept me from going. I wanted passionately to meet Charles's mother.
On Tuesday, Laurie remarked suddenly, our teacher had a friend come in to come to school to see her.
Charles's mother? My husband and I asked simultaneously.
Nah, Laurie said scornfully. It was a man who came and made us do exercises. We had to touch our toes. Look, he climbed down from his chair and squatted down and touched his toes.
Like this, he said.
He got solemnly back into his chair and said, picking up his fork, Charles didn't even do exercises.
That's fine, I said heartily. Didn't Charles want to do exercises?
Nah, Laurie said. Charles was so fresh that the teacher's friend,
He was so fresh to the teacher's friend, he wasn't let to do exercises.
Fresh again, I said.
He kicked the teacher's friend, Laurie said. The teacher's friend told Charles to touch his toes like I just did, and Charles kicked him.
What are they going to do about Charles, do you suppose? Laurie's father asked him.
Laurie shrugged elaborately.
Throw him out of school, I guess, he said.
Wednesday and Thursday were routine. Charles yelled during story hour, hit a boy in the stomach and made him cry. On Friday, Charles stayed after school again, and so did all the other children.
Within the third week of kindergarten, Charles was an institution in our family. The baby was being a Charles when she cried all afternoon.
Laurie did a Charles when he filled the wagon full of mud and pulled it to the kitchen.
Even my husband, when he caught his elbow in the telephone cord and pulled the telephone ashtray and bowl of flour off the table, said after the first minute, looks like Charles. During the third and fourth week, it looked like a reformation in Charles. Laurie grinned, reported grimly at lunch on Thursday of the third week.
Charles was so good today, the teacher gave him an apple.
What? I said, and my husband asked warily.
You mean Charles?
Charles, Laurie said. He gave the crayons around, he picked up the books afterward, and the teacher said he was her helper.
What happened? I asked incredulously.
He was her helper, that's all,
Laurie said and shrugged.
Can this be true about Charles? I asked my husband that night. Can something like this happen?
Wait and see, my husband said cynically. When you've got a Charles to deal with, this may mean he's only plotting.
He seemed to be wrong. For over a week, Charles was the teacher's helper. Each day, he handed things out. He picked things up, and no one had to stay after school. The PTA meeting's next week again, I told my husband one evening. I'm going to find Charles's mother there.
Ask her what happened to Charles, my husband said.
I'd like to know. I'd like to know myself, I said. On Friday of that week, things were back to normal. You know what Charles did today, Laurie demanded at the lunch table in a voice slightly awed. He told a little girl to say a word, and she said it, and the teacher washed her mouth out with soap, and Charles laughed. What word? His father asked unwisely, and Laurie said, I'll have to whisper it to you. It's so bad. He got down off his chair and went around to his father. His father bent his head down, and Laurie whispered joyfully. His father's eyes widened. Did Charles tell the little girl to say that? He asked respectfully. She said it twice, Laurie said. Charles told her to say it twice. What happened to Charles? My husband asked. Nothing, Laurie said. He was passing out crayons. Monday morning, Charles abandoned the little girl and said the evil word himself 3 or 4 times, getting his mouth washed out with soap each time. He also threw chalk. My husband came to the door with me that evening as I set out for PTA meetings. Invite her over for a cup of tea after the meeting, he said. I want to get a look at her. If only she's there, I said prayerfully. She'll be there, my husband said. I don't see how they could hold a PTA meeting without Charles's mother. At the meeting, I sat restlessly scanning each comfortable matronly face, trying to determine which one hid the secret of Charles. None of them looked, to me, haggard enough. No one stood up in the meeting and apologized for the way her son had been acting. No one mentioned Charles. After the meeting, I identified and sought out Laurie's kindergarten teacher. She had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of chocolate cake. I had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of marshmallow cake. We maneuvered up to one another cautiously and smiled. I've been so anxious to meet you, I said. I'm Laurie's mother. We're all so interested in Laurie, she said. Well, he certainly likes kindergarten, I said. He talks about it all the time. We had a little trouble adjusting the first week or so, she said primly. But now he's a fine little helper with occasional lapses, of course. Laurie usually adjusts very quickly, I said. I suppose this time is Charles's influence. Charles? Yes, I said, laughing. You must have your hands full in the kindergarten with Charles. Charles, she said. We don't have any Charles in kindergarten. You got any Charles in your class? Oh, the poor parents. How many figured it out before we got there? I don't think I did the first time. Okay, good for you. You started realizing that something's not right. My students love that one about, hey, Pop, you'll dust mop. But they did not say it to their fathers that I'm aware of. So that's good. Why teach literature? Well, ultimately, all things are right for the glory of God. So there's got to be the glory of God involved. If it's something that's not bringing glory to God and obviously is the opposite, well, then we have a problem. And hopefully, why we're teaching literature, why we read literature, also, if we can have this is why we're doing it, then also we can help bring them along, right? If you don't know why you're doing something, they do, you know, you get your students out sometime and say, shovel a hole. Fill it back up again. Shovel another one. You're going to lose interest and enthusiasm unless it's a lot more fun than their math lesson or something. But you get them to do something pointless with no apparent reason, you're bound to lose interest. That's pretty much a given. And so you got them reading these big, long stories and this isn't working. You're bound to lose interest. Hopefully, if you get some whys behind it, it'll also help to encourage love of it. For wisdom, you want to gain insight. You want to be warned about things. You want to be encouraged, inspired, enlightened, all kinds of aspects of wisdom. You want to teach students to engage with written words. Can they take a written word, a whole bunch of them in fact, and does it make sense to them? Can they sort it out? We talked, I think, in here about the other day about a first grader. By the time they get to the last word, now they can't remember what the first word was, and they have a hard time. But you got to be able to put this whole thing together. By the time they get a little older, a few older grades, well, they can put all those words and sentence together, hopefully, but can they hold this whole thing together and they see where this thing is headed and they can engage with these words. Think about concepts. Think about ideas. Learn new words. Did you learn any new words when you ever read a story? Do you look them up? Do you check that? That's easier said than done. You may think, oh yes, we check every new word. I remember one time when I was younger, there was one of our parents' friends that gave this book, and this was huge. And he thought we should read it about some, I don't even know what it was about anymore. And so I was sitting there one night looking at it, but I realize I'm going to need a dictionary just to get through. The context isn't the context. I don't even understand the context, let alone some of these words. And someone came past, you're reading that book. And, oh, they said, I see you're reading a dictionary, not the book, because you needed to. And I didn't get very far, not surprisingly, because I didn't understand enough of it. I don't know if I still would with the level that was at. It helps us to see ourselves. Did you see yourself in Charles? Did you see yourself in Charles's mother? Do you see yourself in Charles's father? That story would be another interesting one to discuss. What are some major weaknesses in that story? What I think is one of the major ones anyway is who's the dumbest person in that family according to the story? The parents, and specifically which one?
Mom.
Dad.
Okay, I see where you're headed. From face value, not looking behind it, as you go along, who is portrayed as the dumbest one until you get to the end and it all fits together, right? I think the dad is constantly doing dumb stuff, right? And the mother, is pointing out how unwise he is. But anyway, we won't spend all day on that one. Think of what Prophet Nathan did after King David sinned. He comes and says, I got a story for you. There was some sheep and shepherds, and one shepherd had a whole bunch, and the other shepherd just had one. And the rich man stole it, and David got furious and proclaimed judgment on that man severely. And then Nathan said, well, by the way, that would be you. Whew. A story set everything up. Imagine Nathan striding in there, because David had just committed. I mean, if someone's willing to do all that, I'd be a little worried. I mean, he sent someone else to the front lines of battle to have him killed. There's no reason we can't send this fellow there too. I mean, it's all one and the same, right? But this story is what brought it. And so often that can help us see truth and see ourselves for what's really going on. It can show truth in action, as we said. It can turn facts into practical examples. Now, let me find that one. This, I think, I hope, is a hyperbole. A little bit. So you could say you should share, or you could say this. Let's just get part of it. There's quite a bit. This goes on for a while, but this is talking about life in the frontier in this particular town. I don't think it was even a real one, as I understand it. A girl came in to borrow a wash dish because we've got company. Presently she came back. Mother says you forgot to send a towel. The pen and ink and a sheet of paper and a wafer is no unusual request. And when the pen is returned, you're generally informed that you sent an awful bad pen. I've been frequently reminded of this sketch. A man returning a broken wheelbarrow to a Quaker said, here, I broke your rotten wheelbarrow on using it. I wish you'd get it mended right away because I want to borrow it again this afternoon. The Quaker is made to reply, friend, it shall be done. And this writer says, and I wish I possessed more of his spirit. You can tell people they should borrow all whatever lessons you want to apply. You read that? You can about picture that, right? Wheeling up this wheelbarrow and it's half broken and that whole story. Stories do so much to go from dry facts you should share to here's an example and maybe an extreme example. I don't think we'd require our students to... And to require them to do that is maybe the ultimate, but at least get them that direction, right? Understanding other cultures, that is an ideal thing that stories can do for us. And you've got all kinds of, there's all kinds of cultures that your students might want to understand. Here's a story on someone who set up housekeeping in Cambridge, England. No sooner have we set up housekeeping in Cambridge from America, that is, and the full impact of this inconsistency hit me firmly between the ears. I set out on my first shopping expedition with disposable diapers at the head of my list, the British for diaper being napkin. I entered the nearest chemist's shop with a request for a package of disposable napkins. The clerk favored me with an empty stare. Paper ones, I elaborated, the kind you throw away when they're soiled. Now a gleam of understanding crossed his face. You mean serviettes, he told me, placing on the counter a package of paper dinner napkins. These are serviettes, I marveled. Yes, madam, 2 and 6 pence the packet. I believe you Americans call them napkins. Aha, let's start over again. I want some disposable diapers to put on a baby. I described them at length, concluding humbly. You see, I thought they were called napkins. He fingered his chin, smiling. Well, we do, but no one ever says anything but nappies. Paper nappies, that's what you want. Paper nappies they were, and the chemist was out of them. She goes on to the store, and she tries to figure out what to call. What's British for cornflakes? Maize flakes, perhaps? Then I spied a familiar package on the shelf. One of those, please, I pointed, turning the package around to discover its name. Cornflakes. I relaxed a bit. I read off the rest of my list. Anyway, he goes down. My last request was for a sponge. I had given a smallish box labeled sponge and displayed a handsome picture of a large golden cake. What's this, I ask. Sponge, madam, in a box. You simply add water and bake, and you have a lovely sponge just like the one in the picture. Oh, and I muttered to myself in American. What does that mean? That makes it sound like there's two different languages, but that's the whole point, right? They are sort of talking two different languages. I muttered to myself in American, I mean the kind of sponge used to clean up the kitchen.
That would be a washing up sponge, the clerk pointed out. You might try the hardware shop. And those there's story, you can read stories for days that give an idea of how this works. And you know what? Those people in Britain aren't wrong. There's nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with us. Well, at least the way we use words, right? There's nothing wrong with either culture, right? Inherently. And it helps to you can drill that in, you know? There's nothing wrong with calling them sponge or cakes or washing up sponges or nappies or whatever else you've got. But it produces interest. It can produce empathy for other people. We heard this morning about reading missionary stories, or stories of people who don't live near as comfortably as we do, or people who lived in other places, or people that live in other times can help to produce empathy. Increases fluency of reading. The more you read, the more you can read, hopefully. Now, see, practice makes perfect, right? No, that is not true. Only perfect practice makes perfect. You can have students that sit there and read a word incorrectly. And some of your best readers sometimes do not know how to pronounce things because they spend all their time reading it and not actually listening to having it read. In some cases, not often, but it will hopefully produce fluency and you'll increase reading comprehension. The more you can read, the more you can read. Applying some of these things too, it broadens your worldview. It helps you understand how other people think because stories are people thinking, right? And it can showcase excellent writing. Imagine trying to make something that you've never seen before. You've only kind of heard of it. And that's why that I'm sure other classes talk about it too. You don't just assign them things. You know, do the math lesson. See you tomorrow. Write an article. See you tomorrow. But get them started with things. That's what those creative writing books look excellent. I never saw them before, but I love it. It gives so many things. If you write about this, not a 600-word essay about this, but start, do something. And that will help. If you show good writing, show good words. We talk about original writing. Did you ever write something that no one ever wrote before? I hope not, because I couldn't read it. I can only read what other people write. And so we push our students to be original, but on the other hand, how are they ever going to be original? But I think we often mean not cliches, obviously. But the more you expose them to all kinds of different ways to say it, hopefully the more they can write things in an interesting way that aren't just the same old boring ways everyone else has. It gives you new perspectives and new ideas. And here's one of my favorites. Sorry, I should keep track. Here it is. Now, this is not me writing, so obviously. My mother, I might note, was a master at trench warfare during my own stubborn adolescent years. And now we're talking about, right, giving you ideas of how to handle things. My father was a full-time minister and frequently on the road, so Mom had the primary responsibility of raising me. I was giving my teachers a hard time during this year and on several occasions was sent to the principal's office where I received stern lectures and a few swats with an infamous rubber hose, which was permissible back then. This discipline did not change my bad attitude, however, and my mother became increasingly frustrated with my irresponsibility and dropping grades. It wasn't long before she reached her limit. One day after school, she sat me down and said firmly, "I know you have been fooling around in school and ignoring your assignments. I also know you've been getting in trouble with your teachers." She always seemed to know. She always seemed to have a team of detectives who told her every detail of my private life, although today I think it was little more than keen mind, good eyes, and unbelievable intuitive skills. She continued, "Well, I've thought it over and I've decided I'm not going to do anything about what is going on. I'm not going to punish you. I'm not going to take away privileges. I'm not even going to talk about it anymore." I was about to smile in relief when she said, "I do want you to understand one thing, however." You caught that he was in high school, right? Just give him the mic. "I do want you to understand one thing, however. If the principal ever calls me about your behavior, I promise you the next day I'm going to school with you. I'm going to walk 2 feet behind you all day. I'm going to hold your hand, young man, in front of all your friends in the hall and at lunch. I'm going to enter into all of your conversations throughout the whole day. When you sit in your seat, I'm going to pull my chair alongside you, or I'll even climb into the seat with you. For one full day, I will not be away from your side." That promise absolutely terrified me. It would have been social suicide had my mommy following me around in front of my friends. No punishment could have been worse. I'm sure my teachers wondered why there was such a sudden improvement in my behavior and a remarkable jump in my grades near the end of my freshman year of high school. I simply couldn't run the risk of Mom getting that fatal phone call. I hope my children never misbehave that badly. That would be kind of neat. When I read that one, I thought, hey, I've got some parents to send this home to. Actually, I had a parent do that, not quite this bad, but she showed up and she sat there. I wasn't sure if it was for my sake or the students was the problem, and that was a little nerve-wracking. Literature stories, and we've been saying this in other ways too, but they drive home a point without directly saying it sometimes. And like Charles, it drives home a huge point without ever, never does say it. I think that's one of the skills of a good writer, if he's comfortable with not saying everything. You ever read a story where they had to explain to you every detail and what you're supposed to figure out? You lost them. Don't bother doing that. But it takes some bravery to let it go at that. And the last one is for the sheer joy of reading. I think there is a tremendous value in enjoyable reading. Now, if there's no value of any sort otherwise, I'm not sure I want to spend a lot of time arguing over that. I'm pretty sure I don't actually. But there is the joy of reading. And I think if your students never feel that thrill, do you have students at math class? And they're sitting there reading their story, right? They're not ignoring you. They're not that kind of person. And you call it again, and then you figure out about that time they totally didn't. And they jump, and they, you know, that's great. That's great. They are into the story. They understand it. And I don't think I've ever gotten very hard on someone who was so engrossed in a good story that they totally didn't hear you. And I think it's wonderful when they're enjoying it. One other thing that literature can do is it provides a reference where you can say a whole bunch of things in a short amount of time. I was in someone's office one time, and these people had both had the perspectives of, I get to mix up life or truth, I think it is, in their school years. And this person had been out of school for probably 15 years, and it started to snow. And I think this person actually cleared snow for a living, so the more snow, the better, right? And he's sitting there working, I'll not have it snowing! Everybody recognize that? Anybody know why he said that? Does that make any sense to anybody? Was he mad about snow? How many think he was mad at snow? Well, of course not. He was referencing the story that he had back in school about Hayes and Kinch, right? Remember Hayes and Kinch? It's going to snow. I'll not have it snowing! And it did snow, right? And so, in that way, there wasn't any life lesson that he portrayed in that, but in that way, he spoke, he communicated a tremendous amount of things, and everyone kind of smiled, right? Someone once, before a little speech, they said something, I've been doing this, whatever they were speaking on, for about 100 years, and the person looked like they were about 50, and they mentioned, oh, did my nose just grow? Does that make any sense to anybody? What is it?
Pinocchio,
right? You watch that, and you watch a person thinking, your nose, no, it didn't grow. But they communicated a whole bunch of things, and I don't know much about that story. I haven't read other than that. I know if your nose is growing. His nose grew when he told lies, right?
Yeah.
I don't actually. What's that?
A little wooden puppet.
A little wooden.
His nose grew every time he told a lie.
And I don't know what the rest of that, and I hope that points out you shouldn't lie. I'm not actually sure where that ends, so maybe I shouldn't use it. Anyway, so I tell you from another world-famous piece of literature that the Lord is my shepherd. How many of you think that God's at home taking care of my five sheep? Oh, he is, I know, but you don't get this impression that apparently the person that's checking on the water of my sheep is named Lord. No one thinks that, right? You think about a tremendous, huge subject with a couple words because you understand literature. If someone told you not to be such a Scrooge, would you know what to do? Stop screwing in the, turning a screwdriver? Would you, right? We talk about the patience of Job. You're thinking of a whole book's worth of information, right? By one phrase. And that's what understanding literature does. Now, can you read everything that everyone's going to refer to? Well, of course not. Various times, I just said we study the perspectives of truth. A student is trying to figure something out or there's something I think is obvious, and I tell them, look, look, look! Do they think I'm all mad at them? They usually smile. Remember that story about the fish, the man that got the fish out? And he had this fish, and he didn't want to study the fish. And he said, study the fish, and then he went out, right? And you read that story in there. It's really interesting. And he just Yeah, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I mean, he's look at the fish. And eventually that's what his professor said. Look, look, look! And at least that's what I think it sounded kind of like. And they love this story, right? And so repeat that. They know I'm not upset at him. It's a reference. But it's still there, right? It's, what did someone say the other day? A rubber sword. You know, you can make a point but not draw blood. And so you make a point that, okay, you're supposed to be looking, right? It actually takes work to look, because you go through that story in that book and you dissect everything and you talk about what the point of looking, all that stuff is. And so in a small words, and there's all kinds of other things. We talk about someone being good Samaritan. You know, well, sorry, that's not my lineage, so I can't. You know, obviously, it portrays a whole section. Has literature ever changed your worldview or impacted your life? Any testimonies? Testimony time.
About Pilgrim's Progress.
I'm sure that has done different things for different people, and I have no idea the impact that must have had on Christians everywhere, right? What else?
I once read a book about the black stallion, actually, and it actually affected my dreams for the next daydream of what I wanted to do when I got there.
Oh, okay. I see.
I mean, I was just a little bit...
It gave you some aspirations,
yeah.
Right? Good.
I wanted to go to the Middle East all of a sudden.
Interesting. What did Abe Lincoln supposedly tell Harriet Beecher Stowe? And I, every source I've ever heard of any significance always says that this isn't provable, but I understand it's in the Stowe family thing, and anyway, we'll go with it.
The little lady that caused the big war.
So you're the little lady that started the big war by writing
Uncle Tom's Cabin,
right? Did she impact history? Possibly, because she gave everybody, including the South, which obviously they read it because they tried to write all kinds of oppositions to it and prove it and all that. They didn't like it. It's so, I understand this is still true, that is the only book that is, it's the Bible, best-selling across time is Bible, and then Uncle Tom's Cabin. I think I'm right on that. And I read that recently here too, so I think that's pretty, that's amazing. It's an interesting piece of writing. You analyze that. Some very concise writing saved my life one time. It was four letters that said stop to the person that was coming. And here I am, I could go past without getting a crash, right? Okay, so that's simplistic, but good writing probably won't save your life, but it might improve your life, right? I know stop signs are not considered literature, but it's an example of good, clear, concise writing, if you want something like that. Do you think the Bible would have the impact? Now, okay, so the Bible's the Bible and it provides salvation. But do you think the Bible would have such an impact, especially on people who are seeing it for the first time, if it wouldn't have captivating stories? And I don't know, I don't have a remedy for this complaint, and so you shouldn't complain unless you have a remedy, right? But for anyone who has heard it, for as long as you can remember, you don't remember hearing it the first time, it's easy to have it wear off. And you just know what's going to happen. And any story you've heard so often, it's easy to kind of tune out to it, get to the end and see. But Surely the stories, there's a reason Jesus told stories. It wasn't because he didn't know what else to do, so have story time. It's because that is an excellent way. So literature can impact life, and maybe in heaven Jesus could tell us how many people were started on the journey just strictly through interesting stories. And there are stories, the Rottenstaff reader, I forget which one, has a story about the husband that came in and ripped the Bible in half, and the wife was reading the first half, got to the end of the prodigal son, he says, I shall go home and go say to my father. And she could about barely stand it because what actually happened? And the husband, who got all mad at the story, picked up the Bible right where it started. And I will not be your son, I'll be your servant. And I forget where it exactly started. I wonder what that man did. That's awful to go from son to servant. And it bothered him and it bothered her, and they weren't talking for days, right? And so finally she said, look, just say what you want, but I must know. I hope you didn't burn the other half because I want to know what happened. And he said, yeah, I'd like to know too. And anyway, the rest is history, I guess to say. What makes good literature? And I know we're overlapping somewhat. I'm doing all the talking, so call it out when you think of something. Obviously, it has to promote truth, which is why we're not reading, I hope, stories that are promoting some false doctrine. Now, that we said that yesterday, and I was wondering if we're going to have to if we should explain or give that story about the contents of Dead Man's Pocket. But we said yesterday, he seemed completely godless. And sometimes, I guess it depends on your students, but sometimes you have to point that out. Now, this is not, he is not approaching this. This is real life for him, but he, you know, see, here is where he's missing the steps where he should be involving God and all those things. So in some cases, maybe you want to explain. I know of a teacher that read a story, and he told his students that now, I've read this with students, and they came home and reported their parents, this teacher is reading a story about divorce. Yeah, that did happen, or it was about to happen in there, but it was probably more, it was probably more about redemption than divorce. But this child stopped partway through, and so this teacher explained it to his students. Okay, I know these. It looks like that. So it must promote truth, and for sure not promote falsehood, and or promote a wrong lifestyle and things like that. That's obvious, I guess. And on that thing, there is a standard. This you all know, but it's a basic principle. This is not some vague kind of, well, sort of, is this true? What is truth? Why that's it? All that. Bible tells us what we're supposed to think on, right? What sort of things are true?
Honest.
These are all standards to run stories by. Honest. Just.
Pure.
Lovely. And of good report, right? So those are excellent things. Now, can you ever read a story that's the opposite? Well, sure, Jesus had all kinds of stories about people who weren't doing right, but it came out, right? So I'm not trying to suggest to you that, well, that story talks about someone who wasn't living right or something like that. I don't think it should be glorifying that. That's a different deal. But Jesus had all kinds of stories in that category. There are stories that work against what we're trying to do as a Christian education. So you've got reports, I mean, you've got lessons in your history book about war, right? There's a whole difference, I'm suggesting anyway, between a story about this is what happened versus all the boys are marching off and all this and this is great and get them pumped up, patriotic. Being patriotic, I'd also in there say let's not, you know, you get people that are just complaining about the country they live in too much too. But there's a difference between promoting patriotism and studying about this is a fact of what happens. And, you know, that's where I think that's what's makes it a lot easier about Christian-based curriculum, because we don't have to deal with that. Or making light of some dishonesty. I'll tell you the story quickly. I was thinking about reading it. So this story is that this boy was in jail, and as an example of it's interesting, but is it right? So this boy's in jail, and his dad wrote to him, you know, he's getting old, he wishes he could till up the garden, but you're not here to help me. So he telegrams back, don't till up the garden, that's where all the guns are buried. Well, the next day, as you can about guess, all kinds of policemen come out there, dig around for a while, and they don't find anything, and the father writes back, I don't know what you're talking about, it doesn't make any sense. Well, he said, now your garden's tilled. So that's an interesting story, but you read stories like that, what's it doing? Well, lying's fine if it works out, right? That's what that story is saying, basically. Now, you can use that. I hope I can use that for an example, and you understand that, right? But when you're feeding on that kind of thing, you're bound to start to skew your worldview. Other things on just basics on good literature is not boring and predictable, hopefully, because you get these things where it's just, you know what's going to happen by the first or second page. Oh, well, it's two boys, and you read that father is leaving to go somewhere. Yeah, you know what? You know what's going to happen next. They're going to get into some trouble. Here's an interesting story that. Okay, so you're going to understand it, right? Maybe your students won't, but it's a story that what it's doing is it is saying the opposite of what it should say. It's from Uncle Tom's Cabin again. And it's, I'll just read it. A slave warehouse. Perhaps some of my readers conjure up horrible visions of such a place. They fancy some foul, obscure den, some horrible place. But no, innocent friend. In these days, men have learned the art of sinning expertly and genteelly, so as not to shock the eyes and senses of respectable society. Human property is high in the market, and is, therefore, well fed, well cleaned, tended, and looked after. That it may come to sale sleek and strong and shining. A slave warehouse in New Orleans is a house externally not much unlike many others, kept with neatness, and where every day you may see arranged under a sort of shed along the outside rows of men and women who stand there as a sign of the property sold within. Then you shall be courteously entreated to call and examine, and shall find an abundance of husbands, wives, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, and young children to be sold separately or in lots to suit the convenience of the purchaser. And that soul immortal, once bought with blood and anguish by the Son of God when the earth shook and the rocks rent and the graves were opened, can be sold, leased, mortgaged, exchanged for groceries or dry goods to suit the phases of trade or the fancy of the purchaser. And he goes on to talk about how much fun it is. They even have someone there specially to help keep everybody entertained. And they got a fiddle going the whole time in case someone's inclined to think about where they came from and their wife and their children. Well, that's obvious to you, right? And so in that case, it's glorifying how nice slavery is actually fine. You can sin properly now. You can keep it up. So it's not promoting that. It's actually doing the very opposite. Now, maybe some student wouldn't notice that, wouldn't catch it. Some types of literature. There's short story. That's kind of what we've been focusing on. There's nonfiction. That is, of course, not fiction. It's real people, real events. There's poetry. We talked about that the other day. Drama and folk literature are the other two that come in a lot of descriptions. Folk literature has some interesting ones. Some of them are fables and legends and some wild tales that take someone better than me to understand. So, let's go next to this thing with literature throughout the curriculum. We said the first day that maybe this is the most important subject you're going to teach in school. Does literature apply to devotions?
Yes.
How? Maybe this is, I was told, one class they told us not to ask such easy questions if you feel insulted, but let's pop it out. Let's go. What is it?
Examples.
Stories.
Something that the younger children can understand but without being insulting to the intelligence of the older ones.
Right. Now that's a good story if you can find those. And there's lots of them around. It takes some. And we already said there's all kinds of stories in the Bible. How do you read a really exciting story that you have your students grasping just worried about it? So maybe the story of the Good Samaritan isn't grasped to them anymore. They know it. But for sure, don't let them down by droning about it. And here we go again. And then, read the story, not dramatically, not way wild, but read the story like you would read a good story. It is a very good story. Read it emphatically. Include stories read or told. Go ahead.
Seth told of one of his substitutes when he was teaching that took a verse from Judges, and where Samson slew the lion in a time of snow and threw it into a pit and totally wove the whole story out. You almost could make quality literature out of a short story in the Bible with just a few verses.
There's so many things to add that we don't know. And of course, we're not changing what truth, obviously, but there's all kinds of things. Or you pull in different things together. You ever hear someone go through a story that's one of the Gospels, and you've got all these other things. That is reading a verse here and there. You can weave it together, make a good story. Math class, literature in math class.
Story problems.
See, it keeps coming up. Tell story problems. Well, yeah, good story problems for one. I remember one thing that was told me that I try to tell students periodically about a man. They called him Calculator John. Is his name. I think he was related to me somehow, but it got diluted out until it got to me. Trust me. And he was at the bank one day. This is a story that hopefully gets your attention. He was at the bank one day, and there was a whole list of numbers, big numbers, right, that the cashier was typing in. And he, before she had it typed into her typewriter or calculator, he told her what it's going to be. So she finished, and he was right, and it was something he obviously didn't know before. She said, "Wow, I should have your head." And like some of these people who are so smart, there, he said, "Yeah, but I don't know what to do with yours." I also remember my first grade teacher having some quality literature time, saying she met a man once, and he had all his fingers cut off his hand. How do you ever think he did his math lessons? Okay, you quit counting on your fingers, right? Learn your facts. And I still remember it. I mean, I remember the lesson. I don't know if I remembered her. I don't know if I took the lesson right away. But, your fingers could all go. I mean, first grade, that's a big deal. You got your fingers cut off, right? How did he ever do his lessons? How did he ever add? He didn't have fingers. And there's always this thing in first grade, maybe my fingers will get cut off too. I better learn. I don't ever do that one either. But
Stories are not to scare people into good behavior, or are they? Is that okay?
Sure.
One person said, I'd rather be scared into heaven than just drift happily into hell. So, there's something. I remember my first grade teacher also kindly asking, would you like us to quit reading that storybook? I said, I think you can keep going because I believe he's going to make it. And you know what he did? It was the greatest thing. I made it too. But using that story, and I still remember that because I thought, you know what? There was like 20 of us in first grade or something. And I was amazed. I didn't think she knew how scared I was. And that really drove home that, you know what? She's smarter than I thought. And I also remember thinking she's a lot kinder than I thought she was. So we had a few instances where I wasn't so sure anymore. But now I think she was. English. Well, of course, you should read, write, and encourage science. Wouldn't it be great if every science lesson was thrilling? The text in the book, right? Well, I'm not criticizing a science writer that can't get everything thrilling. There are some facts that can be difficult to keep every student together. But how many read that story, The Night the Stars Came Out? The stars are coming out once every 1,000 years. No, 100,000, I think it was. Every 1,000 years, the stars would come out. And this weaves this whole thing around what people are going to do. And they had, of course, these people that would sell fancy neck pillows and all kinds of other things to help you look at the scars. These scoundrels that would go around selling all kinds of wild things. And somebody made up special sunglasses because, you don't know, it might fry your eyes. We only know about it from that. And this whole thing. And the point was, you really ought to go look at the stars. And it says, you know, the stars come out every night and we just open the newspaper and read it. And imagine what would happen. It goes in this big, long thing. You know, warring countries would call a peace treaty for at least that one night. That way they all could look at the stars. And people in factories and hospitals would offset shifts so they could each look at the stars. And some people would go out the next night just in case they came early, because 1,000 years ago, we're not sure exactly which day. It's an intriguing way of saying, hey, you ought to go out and look at the stars. History. How can you... Are speeches good literature?
Literature has to be written, doesn't it?
I don't know. Does it have to be written? I don't know if I thought about that before.
Well, there's oral storytelling.
There is. That's an industry, from what I can tell. There's people that gather, make their living off of oral storytelling. I read of the exercises this one lady does before she goes in storytelling. It makes our singing exercises sound kind of wimpy, and they're not wimpy, don't worry. It's an elaborate thing, because that's a big deal. One person actually sprained one of her friends sprained their tongue. She said, yeah. They have tongue exercises, and they actually sprained their tongue, so she said, you want to be careful with these. Anyway, sorry, we're off topic.
If you have a literary work, would you picture anything but something written down?
I'm thinking, I don't know. That's an interesting thought. I was going to say, yep, speeches are great literary pieces. I still think you can say it. Because it's not all of a sudden not literature if you read it. But if it wasn't written... Anyway, I don't know that
sorry,
matters. No. I like that. That's an interesting thought. I hadn't really deciphered that.
But Dean said the other day that he does a lot of his writing via speaking into his computer or something like, or cell phone. That's his cell phone.
That's interesting.
He's sending an email to his wife, and she types it.
That's really interesting. So there's a piece of literature that starts as a speech, or as talking. Mm-hmm. I'm going to suggest... Whether you go home and decide if it's literary or not, but I'm going to suggest that you reading speeches that have some kind of quality to them, if it's literary quality or otherwise, are interesting. It makes, you know, you can read in that Martin Luther King Jr. and his I Have a Dream, but read it. There's a book out there called Speeches That Changed the World. Do you read that? And that has a whole bunch of recordings on there too, and that's interesting to listen to. That's all. You listen to him, or listen to the speech of the date that will live in infamy, December 7, 1941. You listen to that speech. Listening does some value.
And you read those things. It makes history come alive too. It's just plain stories. Read stories about what actually happened. History is, I think we ruin it for some students at least by just rattling stuff off. At least I have that trouble. Because to me, this is interesting even if it is a list of dates. You can see the stuff. But this student is just bored out of their mind. It looks about like where they are. But if you can make it come alive with stories. You know, this person, I remember I came across a story of a person that lived through one of the dust storms in the Dust Bowl years. I didn't know that the dust would cover up fences. And they said there is no way to keep it out of their house. Obviously, they were living out in the frontier more so than where it now. But it just never really dawned. I'd seen pictures of it about halfway up to a house, but it never dawned on me that they were describing, there's our fence. Half an hour later, however long, was nothing very long at all. There's no fence. And reading them live through that it made the Dust Bowl, I mean, I think, you know, a little dusty here and there. It was not a little dusty here and there. Does chorus and music have any, is there any literary connection?
Poems.
We already said that's literature. So, and as we've been doing, bring it out. Point it out. Show it. There's all kinds of interest, very well written and interesting stories behind it too. And you start explaining some of those things. It can make things come alive when you realize what this person was doing and going through and watching and just had happened to them or all those things. Art class? Read to them while they work, I guess. I don't have a lot for that one, but I thought maybe someone could help. Or any other class. I'd be glad to hear how else to incorporate some of that. Because I think stories are excellent ways of communicating.
Kind of back to your devotions and Bible class, I did a thing that I'll assume was for an idea. It was around Christmas time, and I wanted to, you know, the Christmas story, well, we've all heard it many times. So my students and I made a 21st century parallel. So we ended up with Joseph and Mary in an old beat up car traveling across the southern U.S. somewhere in desert country. There was a big rodeo going on, so the hotel was full. So she gave birth to Jesus in the garage out back, and the mattresses you laid in a cardboard box. She just paralleled many, many details and made a gripping account for us to think about the hardships that they endured at the time of Jesus' birth.
And there's little details that we assume right over when you got to actually sit down and piece by piece.
In the manger, so we pick a cardboard box. Yeah. A little detail.
Yeah.
But we never did that with another Bible story, but that it moved me and it moved students.
Yeah.
What was the story? I don't remember if we did anything. It's been a while.
Good. What else? All right. One of the things to do as you go along is to analyze fact versus opinion. Maybe we should have this under why you should, to help you analyze fact versus opinion. That is huge in life. I know it feels weird telling students, well, in life, well, I don't know what they're in now, but anyway, when you're out of school, anyway, you got to do that constantly. Fact or opinion. Billboard says, you know, whatever, mostly opinions, camouflaged like facts. You've got to analyze that all the time. And stories are a great way to do that. And you can stop and lead through. You don't have to listen to the salesman in your face and decide it as you go. You can stop and back up and say, you know what? See here where this is headed. And those things are great. How should you read and promote good literature? Well, there's lots of ways probably. Read to the students. Read to them. And practice good, excellent reading skills. And have them read. Have them write, involve them in discussing this thing, and help them to. One thing I wish I could, you know, maybe you have some ideas on this. Is there more than one way to understand everything, and how to decide what this actually means, and when do you say, you know what, no, your theory on what that means, say this nicely, of course, it just isn't cutting it. Whereas, you know what, that's a good theory, and that one is too, and that's. It takes discretion. There's probably a variety of that. And don't just teach great books. Try to teach a love of reading. And it'll go a long way. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your help in discussing this.
And hopefully you can enjoy literature class, or just plain literature if you don't have a class. It'll take you all kinds of places that otherwise we'll never get to go. Dismissed.